Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never, and that debt is fraud, and in our appeal to heaven, we need to continue to learn. Folks, just don't wait for this show to take time to read and get informed regarding our founding documents. Understanding how the Constitution has been defined at the time of ratification is key, because those definitions and terms and conditions during the ratification process are legally binding. So understanding them is critical, because now we actually have full context to whether the federal government is behaving badly or not, and it's no surprise they're demons, possessed, running around and trying to kill us. I know that sounds like hyperbole, but and in answer to your prayers, we actually have Tammy back. They missed you last week, Tammy. And in addition, folks, let's remember that it is all about full compliance to the Constitution. Our focus is not cherry picking. Our purpose is literally demanding every public servant fully comply to the Constitution. And what that means is that they have to support it. If there's anybody that is voting, that is actually passing bills or voting for legislation that is a violation of the Constitution, and you have a public servant that maybe not didn't vote, you know, to violate the Constitution, but they're doing nothing and not calling these people out for violating the Constitution and sounding the alarm, then they are giving aid and comfort, and they're equally violating their oath. Full compliance to supporting the Constitution. Our public servants are our warriors. They're our political warriors in ensuring that our government is in compliance to the rule of law and the supreme law of the land. So I can't put it any better than that. And, again, welcome back, Tammy.
Thank you.
Hey, so we are in the midst of the North Carolina debates. We are on the 28th of July, folks, and we're in the second highlight of Mr. Iredell, and this one is regarding common law. So let's see what Mr. Iredell has to say regarding common law, and it also includes impeachment and so forth. So let's go ahead.
Okay. The power of impeachment is given by this Constitution to bring great offenders to punishment. It is calculated to bring them to punishment for crime, which it is not easy to describe, but which everyone must be convinced is a high crime and misdemeanor against the government. This power is lodged in those who represent the great body of the people, because the occasion for its exercise will arise from acts of great injury to the community, and the objects of it may be such as cannot be easily reached by an ordinary tribunal. The trial belongs to the Senate, lest an inferior tribunal should be too much awed by so powerful an accuser. After a trial thus solemnly conducted, it is not probable that it would happen once in 1,000 times that a man actually convicted would be entitled to mercy, and if the President had the power of pardoning in such a case, this great check upon high officers of state would lose much of its influence. It seems, therefore, proper that the general power of pardoning should be abridged in this particular instance. The punishment annexed to this conviction on impeachment can only be removal from office and disqualification to hold any place of honor, trust, or profit. But the person convicted is further liable to a trial at common law and may receive such common law punishment as belongs to a description of such offenses, if it be punishable by that law. I hope for the reasons I have stated, that the whole of this clause will be approved by the committee. The regulations altogether, in my opinion, are wisely contrived as they could be, are as wisely contrived. It is impossible for imperfect beings to form a perfect system.
So why is it that the president is tried and judged by the Senate and not the Supreme Court?
I don't know.
So if you understand, so I say this every once in a while, and whether you remember it or not, that's okay. There is something very sacred about common law and how they implemented some of those things in the Constitution, where because they did not implement common law, right? We've already covered this. The Constitution does not declare mm-hmm. common law. But what they did was, in certain processes, such as impeachment, they retained the essence of common law. Do you know what that is? It is a trial. It is a trial by jury of the peers. So when we look at the Senate, right? The Senate is a body that is what? Representing what?
That's true, yeah.
It's representing the state legislatures. And they have an equal representation in the Senate. So in other words, each state is able to judge by jury, in a jury form, whether the president be guilty or not, instead of just a couple of judges who are making, as an oligarchy, you know, using politics and so forth. Therefore, they believe that true justice would be served better by maintaining a trial by jury of the Senate. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense.
And so,
yeah, because they more closely work with him because they're in the Senate.
Well, so there's that.
So they,
but the real thing is the court really has a very minuscule responsibility. Very minuscule. They're only the guardians of the Constitution in saying that the Constitution, this things that arise under the Constitution, whether they've been violated or not by the original definitions. They do not have any authority to change that law. They do not have any authority to implement case law or precedents so that they could slowly migrate and evolve law by using case law. In other words, their hands are tied in basically judging a case on law and fact. And the reason why the Chief Justice is the administrator of the court is to ensure the proceedings are done properly. In other words, they're really kind of like mechanics of the law. You know, they can't change your engine. They can't do anything. They just make sure that it's functioning the way it's designed. So helping understand this, because this really plays into what we're dealing with and this concept of wiping out the judicial authority of law, or these assumed powers of interpretation, the assumed powers of creating law, the assumed powers of using case law and precedents, and actually restoring the judiciary back to the blasé, do nothing other than rule on law and fact. No more bending and creating law. No more. So, in talking, because I'm just going to kind of leave it with a generic, in talking to a particular state chair of the Republican Party, I exposed to him this concept of kind of like a trifecta, which I've been covering on Thursday and Friday last week, and yesterday, Monday. And this trifecta basically goes into this grand, I just say the macro view of what's happening with the Trump administration, what's going on in America. Now, one of the key things that we know, Trump has been combating a very hostile court system that has been violating the Constitution, has assumed unconstitutional powers and so forth, and they've allowed themselves to become political activists in trying to maintain their status quo of sending us towards this global oblivion. So Trump has, you know, just putting up one shingle, Trump has a has to correct his responsibility, because the president is supposed to ensure that the Constitution and the branches are actually following their functions. And so the president actually has the ability to basically reel in the courts because Congress won't. And he also has the ability to hold Congress accountable for failing to do that. Because the president actually has the execution of the law. And he has the Department of Justice that can actually go in and say, you have violated your oath, you're gone. All he needs is Section 3. So again, the first shingle is the out-of-scope functioning of the court. The second shingle, or the second, you know, of the trifecta, is, and underneath this, there's this other thing that kind of comes out of this court, this shingle. The other problem is the fact that we have this invasion. And the courts have actually been hamstringing him in not allowing us to repel the invaders in accordance to the Constitution. The Constitution demands that all invaders be repelled, that the United States guarantees to every state in this union the repelling and or protecting them from an invasion, specifically. I mean, that's what Section 4 states in Article 4, that they must protect each state from an invasion. Must. And the process of doing that is repelling them. So as we look at this, the second shingle, this invasion is causing so many problems. It's inflating our housing price. It is basically putting a whole demand, this oversaturated demand on housing itself. Get the invaders out and watch the prices of housing come down, and watch the prices of building and all of these things, because there's no longer this unreasonable demand. America cannot keep up with this invasion. It's in addition to the health problems, in addition to all of the burdens of services and everything else that they're bending over backwards to hand to these people. These invaders who are they're basically pawns. Unfortunately, these people have no idea what the heck they're doing. They're being told to come here, and we're going to take care of them. So those people that are involved in that, they need to be tried and arrested. But we've got this other shingle called the invasion. And so we have one real problem. Now, right now, there's this huge uproar about redistricting, right? Have you heard this? The redistricting of states?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the redistricting...
Yeah, just counting the citizens and not the illegals, this one?
So that's one of those things. That's one of the problems, the redistricting and the apportionment. The real problem is, at the state level, every state is doing redistricting in their state house as well, which means that right now, we're redistricting based on an unconstitutional precedence that was rammed down everybody's throat called the one person, one vote principle. The Supreme Court in the 1960s used the Baker v. Carr, Reynolds v. Sims cases and literally rammed down every state. Wyoming was equally affected, and they took away your county representation in the Senate, and they said you must create legislative districts to account for population, not for these county governments. Who do you think you are creating a county government? We're a democracy. That's exactly what the Supreme Court did. They basically implemented a democratic form of representation instead of recognizing the government of the people, the government that actually created the states, which are the counties, and they basically backhanded America into democracy. So as Trump basically goes and actually holds them accountable to say, you can't make law, you can't interpret law, and if you're going to go down that path, we're removing you. And then he actually has to go to Congress and say, Congress, you need to regulate them in accordance with Article 3 and hold them to their oath that they are to judge all cases based on law and fact. No precedence. There's no allowance in the Constitution for case law and precedence. No interpretation. Yeah. So as we look at this, then the thing that ties all of this together is Section 3. Is Section 3 of the 14th Amendment the supreme law of the land?
I mean, yeah.
Okay. Absolutely. I mean, it's a no-brainer. I know I just asked a real no-brainer. But if it's the supreme law of the land, then why is the president not enforcing it? Why is he allowing the honor of thieves and the status quo to continue? If
he doesn't have a good advisor, that's why.
I'm putting it out here to you because I haven't had this conversation. I've been kind of chomping at the bit. I was hoping we could do this on Thursday last week. But so if Trump actually holds the courts accountable and actually goes after them regarding the invasion and repelling the invasion, and then goes after them regarding the reapportionment that they basically laid into, and says, this edict of the 1960s from the Warren Court was unconstitutional. We'll give you an opportunity to overturn and tell the world that you overreached, you used powers not in the Constitution by creating law. You've been doing it for centuries, and you have a chance now to get it right. You don't get it right, we'll remove you. That means all of the ideologues on the Supreme Court, Jackson, Sotomayor, all of them will be removed. Because if they vote in contrary to what the Constitution demands, which every state is to have their own Republican form of government. How many times have you heard me, when we're going through the ratification debates, state that the Constitution and the federal government was an exemplar constitution, it had limited powers, and it had no control over states? None. As a matter of fact, had the Constitution had some a scintilla of authority to tell the states how their government should be formed, the Constitution would have been rejected based on that. So how is it that all of a sudden, 200 years later, the federal government is telling the states that, you know, actually it happened in the 1860s, I think there was called a Dillon Rule, where a judge basically said the counties mean nothing. Now, the judges don't even have that authority. They can't redefine anything, but that's exactly how they've been functioning, and this is how it was a slow migration from Marshall and Hamilton's Federalist Papers to literally basically have the court system assume all federal powers, or basically assume all powers over the states, which is why the states are in this situation today. If Trump actually...
Did this chair that you spoke with, did he understand the fact that the courts don't have that power?
He or she did understand
or
that.
She, yeah.
He or she did understand that. And
good.
I mean, so because, you know, I mentor a lot of different people and we're kind of going through this. But then I actually mentioned, so because if there's red states out there and if we've got federal attorney generals that are recognizing from these red states that the makeup, the political makeup of the United States has been perverted. Because the counties have lost representation, they've lost their essence, because the courts have overstepped their bounds and got into the knickers of the state's political structure. They don't have that power. Does this make sense? So if we actually
I love it when you use that phrase.
In their knickers?
Not into their knickers.
Yeah. Okay. So, I guess these are old terms. I'm just an old dog, right? So, so when we look at the ramifications of what would happen if Trump had these things overturned and restored the states, and as a matter of fact, the Attorney General or the Department of Justice should actually tell or basically send the message, or actually Trump should be the carrier of the message, hey, all of you counties, because you are the parties to the state constitution. You need to audit your state constitution and determine how many things have been changed because the federal government assumed powers. Wow. Okay, but more importantly, More importantly, by the stroke of undoing what the federal courts did, this means that all redistricting changes to counties. In other words, the county would be in charge of their own redistricting, and the state would not have any power over redistricting other than by population. They would set the standard based on seats. Okay, so your state has 90 seats in the House of Representatives, and based on the overall population of, you know, the states, because you have to guarantee every county one representative. Just like the federal constitution, every county, every state has a right to have representation of their people. So even though they may not have originally thought of this, but this is one of the things that the counties need to stand up and say, we're not marginalizing our representation. We're not going by population. Every county has a right of representation to protect their interests, because county interests are unique. And the city, right, the city is going to want to take up all the resources like they had been proving to do. Therefore, see, here's the problem. Like, let's look at Arizona Phoenix in Arizona. Phoenix has created this huge megapolis, right? I mean, this is a huge city out in the middle of what? The desert. Do they have natural water to their beck and call? No. They have to depend on water to be imported to them. Remember, when I talk about creating a government, it is a wise people that ensures that their government can sustain itself, right? I mean, if you all of a sudden, you know, promise all sorts of things and you can't deliver and you go bankrupt, then the people were pretty foolish in trying to do something like that. Otto von Bismarck did that in Germany, and he basically destroyed them financially. So you have to actually look at what kind of government you really need to give the people, a limited and defined government, and make sure that you can afford that. In addition, you need to make sure that the resources do not get overwhelmed by the people. In other words, if you only have so much water resources, then you should not allow that city to continue to grow. Does that make sense?
I mean, yeah, absolutely.
Because that's what happened to Las Vegas. Las Vegas is in a huge pinch, yeah, where there's, I mean, there's parts of it that have been destituted because people had to abandon their homes. They couldn't get water. And so it's, when you live in the desert, you realize, you know, there's this Sam Kinison. You know who Sam Kinison is? You ever heard of him?
I do not know.
Okay, so there's this, I mean, he's a comedian that died in a car accident. He was really funny. He was a former preacher, and he was really foul-mouthed. And so, I mean, he used curse words left and right. But there's this, you know, snidbit that's out on social media that Sam Kinison says, you know, I know how to fix world hunger. Just stop giving people food. You know, and you go out to these places. Hey, we've been traveling out here to, you know, give you food over the last 30, 40 years, and we're not doing it anymore. What we're going to do is we're going to send you U-Hauls. We're going to send you the resources so that you can move. Because you live in a desert. There's no way you can feed yourself living in a desert. Get out of here. Let the people move to where the food is. I mean, that's only common sense, right? Isn't that common sense?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, I wouldn't stick around.
You know, so there's this classic book that I think Ken Blanchard wrote the foreword on. It's Who Moved My Cheese? If you don't have cheese, why would you even want to put your mouse hole in a desert if there's no cheese there? And you it's crazy. But anyway, all things being equal, getting back to this plan, if Trump actually undoes this reconfiguration of the state, every state in the union would become purple. We're going into a break. But fathom this going in. Look at every state and how many counties. How many counties in all of these states actually have more red counties than blue counties? If you shift back to counties, the Senate in every state turns red. Think about that. We'll be right back after this promo.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so if you really look at, these three shingles that the federal government, or actually the Supreme Court, has overreached their scope. I mean, they're operating well outside the boundaries of the Constitution. The federal courts, way outside the boundaries. They've assumed a jurisdiction and standing over everything that suits them. When it comes to the elections and those types of things, where the Constitution and the Electoral College, because we actually had a lawsuit that we had standing and we had jurisdiction, or they had jurisdiction. And so the overreach of the federal court, the fact that they have been actually supporting the invasion and violating that and holding them accountable by using that as the basis to go in. And in addition, by using a few states, we only need two states, two red states, to actually go after the judiciary for unconstitutionally reconfiguring them. And this is where the Department of Justice could actually pick that up and actually hold the Supreme Court accountable to say, you did overreach, you better fix this. And you better basically make an announcement to the world, you don't have the authority to make law. You don't have the authority to interpret. There is nothing in the ratification debates that has granted you that authority, nor is it in that compact, or the compact, the Constitution. Therefore, when you use the Federalist Papers and it said you could do those things, you actually pulled the wool over everybody's eyes. So, bottom line, as we're going into the redistricting, this other, because these are three things in the news, right? These little three shingles, everybody's kind of looking at, you know, how the Supreme Court is playing, you know, walking this line of, you know, seeming like they're trying to get towards the Constitution, but not going there, like the Chevron case and so forth. But bottom line, mm-hmm. I think Trump could create the synergy between these things. Along with the states, he would need two states where the attorney generals are actually moving into, you know, a lawsuit against the federal government for unconstitutionally reconfiguring their states. And that gets everything rolling to where Trump can now, because he needs, the one thing he needs to do is he needs to gird up his loins, hopefully you like that term, gird up the Department of Justice's loins on Section 3 of the 14th Amendment and say, this is your number one priority. If we're going to clean up America, if we're going to at least undo this grasp that the progressives have put this nation in by the redistricting or changing from counties to creating legislative districts, that's getting undone. That would put America back onto basically its real legs of true politics of our Republican form of government. And I believe that we would actually see the Electoral College change drastically, every state house would change drastically, and the progressives would be probably jumping out of buildings. They just wouldn't know how to counter this. I mean, they've been winning for two centuries. assuming more and more power and taking the power away from the states and actually subjugating the states and enslaving the people, all unconstitutionally. Do you not agree that Trump would probably become the most famous president in the history of the United States? Because it would be that big of a setback to the damage that had been done by the progressives. Because
absolutely, he just needs a better advisor.
Yeah, well, I'm not looking for a job. As a matter of fact, when I call these attorney generals and I call all of these people that I work with, you know, I tell them I'm not looking for a job. I'm here to help you do the right thing so that we can get our country back. But this would actually help set Republic Review in motion as well. Because if the states mm-hmm. actually had to start looking and they audited their constitution, because the reality is, if the federal courts had, they exerted the power of reconfiguring the politics of the state, what else have they done to us? What else has the federal government done to the states by basically saying, we're going to give you money to create an environmental protection agency to interface with us and our unconstitutional roles, responsibilities, and powers? We're going to give you money to create a Department of Transportation. We're going to give you money to interface with our Department of Education. We're going to give you money to set up Obamacare. All of these things would start actually being identified, that they were never amended to properly to the state, because the federal government cannot change a state constitution. There's nowhere in their power to be able to touch the government of a state. A state is the sovereign party over the federal government. This is how the creature became the monster. Because everybody got convinced, the lawyers in the Bar Association, I'm probably painting a big target on my back because I'm making lots of people mad. Oh, well, I get it. Anyway, so let's get back to this. I just wanted to run this down so you kind of see what's happening, because I've been talking about this Thursday and Friday and yesterday. So I'm hoping that we can actually get Trump and the Department of Justice retuned to actually enforcing the Constitution instead of federal statutes, titles, and crap. Because almost all of that is crap. It's all unconstitutional. Anyway, so Mr. Iredell made that comment, and then Mr. Miller makes a comment now regarding the militia, and just keep in mind that what he is saying, so we don't have it highlighted, but you'll notice that there's several highlights that create this thread of conversation. Mr. Miller is an anti-federalist. He's arguing against the Constitution. So let's go ahead and start with that, and then we'll go through Mr. Spate, we'll go through Mr. Porter, Mr. Spate, Mr. Porter, the Governor Johnston, and then Mr. McClain. Okay?
Okay.
All right.
Mr. Miller acknowledged that the explanation of this clause by the member from Edenton had obviated some objections which he had to it, but still he could not entirely approve of it. He could not see the necessity of vesting this power in the president. He thought that his influence would be too great in the country, and particularly over the military, by being the commander-in-chief of the Army, Navy, and militia. He thought he could too easily abuse such extensive powers, and was of the opinion that Congress ought to have power to direct the motions of the Army. That'd be way too slow. That was my comment. He considered it as a defect in the Constitution that it would not expressly provided that Congress should have the direction of the motions of the Army.
Actually, he's confusing things. The Army is the militia. There is no Army. The Army, when the Army is to be formed, they have the power to organize. I think, let me get into it, because I got to say what I got to put it in the terms exactly how the Constitution says this. So in Article 1, Section 8, when we look for the army, it says to raise and support armies. How do they raise armies and support them? It's right down here.
Having a militia.
There you go. It's two down. It is the second one from that. The third one, because to raise armies, to provide, so they're to have a navy at all times, But when there is time for an army, they need to raise and support it. And the action or the way they raise and support it is calling forth the militia. That is it. And this was really clarified so many times in Virginia that the concept of having an army entity and a militia is, you know, disconnected. It is obviating the fact that the army is the federalized militia. It may not be the entire militia, because the army, or I should say, the federal needs may not require every state to provide everybody. The Whiskey Rebellion, when we cover that, it'll be clear. They only called forth four states that were within the vicinage of Pennsylvania so that they could, it'd be easy to gather, federalize, and deploy into Pennsylvania, Western Pennsylvania, to basically suppress the insurrection. And that was the purpose of calling them forth to forming that army. And that army was formed and basically disbanded within a matter of months. Calling them forth, organizing them, marching in, arresting people, bringing them back. It was just a matter of months. So, and then it was done. They didn't maintain the army. They're not to maintain the army. So, again, he is spinning it to make it seem like there is a separate entity called an army. Okay, so Mr. Spate goes ahead and responds.
Mr. Spate answered that it was true that the command of the army and navy was given to the president, but that Congress, who had the power of raising armies, could certainly prevent any abuse of that authority in the president, that they alone had the means of supporting armies, and that the president was impeachable if he in any manner abused his trust. He was surprised that any objection should be made to giving the command of the army to one man, that it was well known that the direction of an army could not be properly exercised by a numerous body of men, that Congress had in the last war given the exclusive command of the army to the commander-in-chief, and if they had not done so, perhaps the independence of America would not have been established.
Okay, and there you go, because what they did, and actually it was Continental Congress that created that charge of giving Washington full cognizance over the Revolutionary Force. Mr. Porter now then goes ahead.
Mr. Chairman, there is a power vested in the Senate and President to make treaties which shall be the supreme law of the land, which among us can call them to account. I always thought that there could be no proper exercise of power without the suffrage of the people, yet the House of Representatives has no power to intermeddle with treaties. The President and seven senators, as nearly as I can remember, can make a treaty which will be of great advantage to the northern states and equal injury to the southern states. They might give up the rivers and territory of the southern states, yet in the preamble of the Constitution they say all people have done it. I should be glad to know that power there is of calling the President and Senate to account.
Okay, so
what power there is. Yeah.
So actually, let me reread something. The president and seven senators, as nearly as I can remember, can make a treaty which will be of great advantage to the northern states and equal injury to the southern states. Now let's do the math. How many states are there? This is the beginning. 13, right?
11,
so let's
13,
so,
yeah.
13, right? So let's just make the assumption that all states go into the Union. At this point in time, by the way, because this is North Carolina, 11 states have joined. 11. So for the president and seven senators to pass a treaty, do you believe that the two-thirds rule of senators is met by passing a treaty with only 7 out of 22, because there will be 22 senators in the Senate based on the 11 states that had ratified the Constitution. So where does Mr. Porter, I mean, why is Mr. Porter misrepresenting the numbers and the facts? Plus, he basically is making the assumption that they can make a treaty that is not within their enumerated powers, which is actually ignoring that little line in the Supremacy Clause, where the Supremacy Clause literally states that treaties made with, or let me get to it, okay, that this Constitution and the laws of the United States, which shall be the laws which shall be made in pursuance thereof. In other words, they're making laws because the Constitution has given them the power to make those laws. That's it. They can't make any laws that they don't have the power of the Constitution to do. And all treaties made or which shall be made, and here's the big kicker, under the authority of the United States. In other words, if it is not enumerated in the Constitution, then they can't make a treaty. It has to be under their authority. And the only thing that creates authority to them are those things that are delegated or granted in the Constitution. So why do these guys do this? They get people, this is how the left even functions today, by creating fear and basically trying to, you know, get people's emotions to run away with them. Because what happens when somebody gets emotional? They lose common sense. Yeah. They start panicking. They start, you know, doing things. As long as you stay calm, as long as you are cognizant of everything you're doing and so forth, and not allow yourself to get distracted. There's an old Seinfeld skit where he was on a date and he was going back to his house or back to his apartment with his date. And they were pretending that there were a horde of gangs, you know, a bunch of gang members that were chasing them to try to get through his door. And he was fumbling with the keys. Come on, come on, come on, come on, come on. And as long as you're distracted, you're not going to get those keys in there and you're not going to get that door open. Don't allow the distractions to get the best of you, because that's your emotions taking over. So, Mr. Spate then responds, but unfortunately, I don't think anybody here actually calls these guys out for, you know, how they're misrepresenting the information being provided, like on the militia. Well, hold on here. The militia is the army. There's no army and militia. The army is formed when they federalize the militia. If we don't have, you know, a need to execute the laws, suppress insurrections, or repel invasions, then there is no army. So anyway, Mr. Spate, let's go ahead.
Okay. Mr. Spate answered that under the Confederation, 2/3 of the states might make treaties, that if the senators from all states attended when a treaty was about to be made, 2/3 of the states would have a voice in its formation. He added that he would be glad to ask the gentleman what mode there was of calling the present Congress to account.
Ah, so how can the states today, under the Articles of Confederation, that's what he's talking about at this moment in time, under the Articles of Confederation, how can the states hold Continental Congress accountable? So Mr. Porter replied.
Mr. Porter repeated his objection. He hoped that gentlemen would not impose on the House that the President could make treaties with 2/3 of the Senate, that the President in that case voted rather in a legislative than in an executive capacity, which he thought impolitic.
All right, so now Governor Johnston, who is actually a Federalist, this is interesting, because most of the other states, well, actually, Governor Randolph was a Federalist, and Governor Johnston was a Federalist, but I believe John Hancock was the president, and I think he was the governor at the time, I think, in the debates. He was also the president or the chair of the debates. And he wasn't necessarily in favor of the Constitution, but it was him that offered the olive branch to say, well, let's ratify and provide the amendments that we demand. Anyway, so Mr. Johnston actually responds in kind. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, in my opinion, if there be any difference between this Constitution and the Confederation with respect to treaties, the Constitution is more safe than the Confederation. We know that 2 members from each state have a right by the Confederation to give the vote of that state, and 2/3 of the states have a right also to make treaties. By this Constitution, 2/3 of the senators cannot make treaties without the concurrence of the President. Here is, then, an additional guard. The calculation that 7 or 8 senators with the president can make treaties is totally erroneous. 14 is a quorum, 2/3 of which are 10. It is upon the improbable supposition that they will not attend that the objection is founded that 10 men with the president can make treaties.
Okay.
Can it be reasonably supposed that they will not attend when the most important business is agitated, when the interests of their respective states are most immediately affected?
Okay, so what he's talking about as far as the 14 is a quorum. With the Constitution, for the Senate to actually function, they have to have quorum. And in other words, they would have to have at least 14 senators. And the premise, the way the Constitution was written, that was based on only 9 states ratifying. But when you look at the attendance of the Senate, out the gate, the states actually manned those seats. And they manned those seats because the states weren't responsible for paying them. Under the Articles of Confederation, you'd heard me say this, that there were states that were actually giving proxy to the, you know, to other members from another state, basically doubling up their votes to other states. Now, you can't tell me
that's not good.
Well, right, but you can't tell me that the Articles of Confederation was a better solution than the Constitution. Even though there were these minimal standards of quorum and so forth, it's still, like he said, even at the least possible number, it would have to be 10 under the Constitution. But the reality was that it would have had to been 2/3 of 22, not 2/3 of, 14. Does that make sense? Because the the states were all in. There was no need to, because the state legislatures weren't having to pay these salaries. They were going to have senators there. They were going to have their representation. Okay, so Mr. Archibald McLean then said this.
Mr. Archibald observed that the gentleman was out of order with his objection that they had not yet come to the clause which enables the Senate and President to make treaties.
Ah, so again, this was a problem throughout, and I highlighted this because, it's great when they call them out and go, hey, hold on here, you're trying to stir the pot before we even get to that point in the pot.
Yeah.
So. And in the Virginia, they kept on going back to the clauses that they already covered. They kept on saying, hey, don't forget that this is a real problem. No, we already dealt with that. And they consistently provided the same stipulations and clarity regarding those clauses. So now we're going to go a little bit further down, and we've got 5 minutes. So Mr. Spencer is an anti-federalist, and he's going to talk ill about jurisdiction. So let's go ahead.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I think that no argument can be used to show that this power is proper. If the whole legislative body, if the House of Representatives do not interfere in making treaties, I think they ought at least to have the sanction of the whole Senate. The worthy gentleman last up has mentioned 2 cases wherein he supposes that impeachments will be fairly tried to the senators. He supposes a case where the president had been guilty of corruption and by that means had brought over and got the sanction of 2/3 of the senators, and that if it should be afterwards found that he brought them over by artifices, they would be a proper body to try him. As they will be ready to throw the odium off their own shoulders on him, they may pronounce sentence against him. He mentions another case where if a majority was obtained by bribing some of the senators, those who were innocent might try those who were guilty. I think that these cases will happen, but rarely in comparison to other cases where the senators may advise the president to deviate from his duty and where a majority of them may be guilty. And should they be tried by their own body, when thus guilty, does not everybody see the impropriety of it? It is universally disgraceful, odious, and contemptible to have a trial where the judges are accessory to the misdemeanor of the accused.
Okay. So, again, he states this, and then down the road, he talks, this was about impeachments, my bad. It wasn't about jurisdiction. But down the road, he does make a comment regarding, again, this is an anti-federalist comment, regarding jurisdiction. It is down on page 95.
We have time. Yeah, okay. Mr. Chairman, I have objections to this article. I object to the exclusive jurisdiction of the federal court in all cases of law and equity arising under the Constitution and the laws of the United States, and to the appellate jurisdiction of controversies between the citizens of different states and a few other instances. To these, I object because I believe they will be oppressive in their operation. I would wish that the federal court should not interfere or have anything to do with controversies to the decision of which the state judiciaries might be fully competent, nor with such controversies as must carry the people a great way from home.
Okay, so with if I can interrupt you right there. What he's basically saying is something that has been stated in almost every state when we go through these debates, because I know it was brought up in Massachusetts. I don't remember Pennsylvania specifically, but I do Massachusetts. I do know Massachusetts. I believe it was also brought up in South Carolina, Virginia, and now North Carolina. Now, I don't think it's brought up. It might have been brought up by the anti-federalists in New York. I don't spend much time on New York just because Hamilton was involved. Now, this right here became, I'll just say, a unifying point for the states, because they recognized out the gate that this jurisdiction between a person of a different state or a foreigner suing a state that they're not a resident of or citizen of, then giving them the jurisdiction over that, basically pulled the states together and said, we're taking this away. And that's why they basically suggested in 94, 5 years out the gate, they said, none, you're not doing this anymore, no more, no mas. And the 11th Amendment was finally ratified in 1798. So that the federal courts could not get involved between cases between a non-state citizen or foreigner and a state. So, the point is he's making was a legitimate point. It was a real problem, and the states corrected it. But everything else, let's just keep going on.
Okay. We have about 23 seconds left, so.
Okay. Actually, so we can just stop there, and we'll just kind of put a pause, and I'll just kind of put paragraph separation. So we'll just pick it up with the respect thereof, or with the respect to the jurisdiction. So when it comes down to the federal jurisdiction, all things arising under this Constitution, that's legitimate, because those are the things granted to them. But that's why nothing that is in the Constitution, if it's not enumerated, they cannot hear the case. But they do. They've assumed and started reaching in and pulling these things in with judicial review. They assumed unlimited jurisdiction. That's not what the Article 3 of the Constitution states. Article 3, Section 2 specifically. Folks, thank you so much for joining us. We will be back with the North Carolina debates tomorrow. God bless. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description version of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.